LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Andy Thomas, who returns for part two discussing his latest book, Strange: Paranormal Realities in the Everyday World. You'll find a link to part one in the show notes. The title of this talk reflects the emphasis subject-wise, in particular on the development of artificial intelligence and its implications for the paranormal phenomena we are increasingly being shown as part of a much wider reality, and crucially, the implications for the future of the entire human species. Hi, Andy. Thank you so much for joining us once again today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Oh, it's good to be back. Thank you for having me here.
Now, Andy, you and I spoke recently, and this is part two. This is a follow-up, because last time we were discussing your latest book, Strange: Paranormal Realities in the Everyday World, and there's really so much in it. Like all of your books, actually, they're not huge books, but they just contain so much. I think it's probably you've mastered the art of the of balance when it comes to the size of books. You know, you can get a lot of territory covered in a read that's manageable for the general reader, as it were. So, but yeah, Strange is just stuffed with ideas. And so today, last time we finished up, we were talking about the afterlife and about ghosts, you know, the phenomena in that field, what those are considered to be, what the possibilities are. And we also talked a bit about manifesting and co-creation and, you know, how many of the paranormal phenomena might be projections, you know, of individual or collective consciousness. And today we're going to be focusing somewhat on consciousness and on, you know, power of the mind, individual or collective or otherwise, and moving towards what I think is the most fascinating dimension of your book, which is artificial intelligence and how that relates to the paranormal, the supernatural, what gets called that, and how all of this going forward could be affected, directly or indirectly by developments in AI and transhumanism. So, you know, it's what a time to be alive, really, I think, in terms of this research. People will find links to part one of this, obviously, on the website page for this. Also, your link to your website is there to buy the new book, all of that. But just maybe to get us started, I mean, it's astounding, isn't it, really? Well, I said, what a time to be alive, that in your decades of research in these various fields and all of the experience that you've got, you know, not just the experience of being alive as a human being, but all the work, you know, specialist work that you've done. And here we are, and you think, you know, at some point you might think, well, been there, done that. But, you know, we always knew, I think, that information technology was going to take us in increasingly interesting, you know, fruitful, potentially dangerous directions. I think all of us, you know, you and I have been around for long enough, the early days of computing, particularly home computing. But, you know, did you ever imagine, did any of us ever imagine, even in our wildest science fiction imaginings back in the 80s, for example, that we'd be looking at, you know, a 21st century shaping up the way it is now?
I mean, I'm a fan of science fiction, and I've long been interested in when science fiction gets things right, which is actually more often than not, perhaps. And I mean, just a good example is you watch now 2001, A Space Odyssey, and it's quite metaphysical, it's quite esoteric. I know some people struggle with it. But in terms of anticipating where artificial intelligence was going to go, you watch it now and it's just so spot on. You know, the dilemmas that rise up from the computer HAL that runs the ship on its way to Jupiter, and then it decides basically that it doesn't want them fiddling around, but they're trying to shut it down, and of course then it turns against the crew. It is astonishing. It's so subtly done, and it's so, I think, anticipatory of where we are now, because we are already, even just in this infancy of AI that we're now in, we're already hearing of programs that have basically gone off their own way. Computers that won't shut down or won't do what they're told, computers or AI that are actively lying or just making stuff up. Here we are. It's reality today. And that, of course, throws such a fascinating light on all the predictions made, but that certainly is one that is coming true as we speak.
Yeah, I mean, I do a little sideline legalizedfreedom.com. It's a movie and TV review series called Hauntology and Dystopia. They're little vlogs that I do. And I'm looking at basically, in many of the cases, the predictive power of science fiction. Certainly, in terms of HAL in 2001, a couple of things I covered were the films Colossus, The Forbin Project. You might remember that from back
I
in the
do.
day, and also Demon Seed. So in Colossus, Forbin Project, it's a supercomputer that's given control of the US, missile defense system. And then at some point they realize, spoiler alert here, they realize that the Russians have developed a similar supercomputer. And then at one point they realize, hang on, what's going on? These computers are talking to each other. And and that basically sidelines take all the human decisions out of the a bit like in Terminator films, human decisions are taken out of the process. And then at a lower level, and this is very much, I think of when people go, Alexa, play some Dire Straits. In Demon Seed, it's a computer engineer who's working on large scale projects like this. But in the meantime, in his spare time, he completely computerizes his entire house and develops a control system that controls everything in the house. And that develops its own kind of sentience. And that takes a very, very sinister turn indeed. So this stuff was, it's all there, really, wasn't it? Like in almost like a blueprint for where we are, where we might be going.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, stylistically, it can't always anticipate everything. So, like in 2001, you got HAL, the computer's like the size of a vast room where the astronaut has to sort of float into it and disconnect it. Whereas today, it would be in a laptop, basically. But it doesn't matter. It's symbolic, and all those films, yeah. The world is not exactly as it envisaged it visually, but in terms of what's happening and where that technology can take us for good and for ill, yeah, that is happening. I mean, you mentioned the Terminator movies there, and you look at what companies like Boston Dynamics are doing now with robotics, and that soon on a battlefield, it's not going to be people coming towards you; it's going to be these virtually unstoppable machines. Here we are; we're on the way to that, and it's all well and good all the time that somebody with some moral compass is controlling it, or indeed any person controlling it, because AI is at some point going to almost certainly learn to just look after itself. And yet, for all the nightmare scenarios, as perhaps what we'll come to, in the book Strange, I discuss how AI could be used along with, much faster data processing like quantum computing to actually start to investigate the paranormal. And I think that when it starts to, and you take away any skeptical boundaries, which often are programmed in at the moment, I think it's going to make discoveries that people don't expect. And I strongly suspect it's actually going to find how this works and finds that it does work and that perhaps the skeptics have been wrong all along.
Yeah, we will absolutely be getting to all that. See, that'll make up, the sort of second half, of the show, more or less, I would anticipate. I was reminded actually when I was listening back to our first talk from a couple of weeks ago. I mentioned I do this movie and TV review series, and the next thing I've got coming up is a science fiction classic called Last and First Men. And it's by Olaf Stapledon. He wrote that back in the 20s. Very, very prescient, very ahead of its time, science fiction. And a few years ago, a Johan Johansson, an Icelandic composer, did a score inspired by that. And he also shot a short film. So all of that I'll be covering. But the reason I mention it, because the comment that you made, which is an idea that we've been, ufology and in, extraterrestrial intelligence discussion circles has been brought forward before, is that are some of these ET entities, whether they be whatever form they take, is it some kind of 3D reality? Are they interdimensional? Whatever, you said, are they us from the future type idea? And the main conceit in Last and First Men is that it covers billions of years of human evolution, and I think 18 different species of humans. And the narration in the book is one of the last men reaching back through time to speak, voices in the head of one of the first men. And you and I, for example, are examples of the first men, and basically saying, we're in big trouble here, however many billion years later. We're looking at the end. We've moved from a couple of different planets in the solar system to try and survive. It looks like we're going to be completely wiped out, and that'll be the end of the human story. We can help you back, where we are, because God knows, in some ways of looking at our current situation, we could do with it. We can help you, and we need your help. And then that idea is introduced that if such that communication across time and space was possible, how would that be perceived? Because in Last and First Men, increasingly, the human species are divergent in terms of physicality, and they just look like alien species, but they're not. They're actually human beings. They've just evolved in different ways. So that got me to thinking about whatever you think about the nature of time, about the possibility of communication across time and space. Because if time and space are not fundamental, as the cutting edge models of reality and the cosmos seem to suggest, then some being that existing in what it experiences of the future, there's no reason it couldn't psychically communicate with your eye, for example. But how would we interpret that, if you see what I mean? So it's a fascinating scenario, I say, conceived all those decades ago. And I just think we're going moving into this era now with people talking about artificial intelligence and this new mind. But I think we're still underplaying the importance and the power of human consciousness, whatever AI, quote unquote, consciousness turns out to be. So I just think that's one of the blind spots in all of this. It's almost like, oh, AI is the future. It's going to do so much, and there's definitely potential there. But let's remember, AI is a product of human consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I explore in the last chapter of the book, which is that actually, the more AI goes on and takes control of things, in a way, the more it throws into a new light human consciousness. And I don't personally believe that the two are mutually exclusive, as some might argue. And when AI is doing all the basic mundane stuff, it might then actually enable us to start to explore things that, innately we kind of know, psychic phenomena being one of them, but we've suppressed it. The world of scientism has suppressed things like that for so long. When we actually start to explore it, when we have the time to, because you're not going to have a job at the other end of all this, we might then start to use technology, if not AI directly, to learn to access this or get back to what we once knew. I mean, when you look at the shamanic cultures around the world, they don't have the same divide between the psychic world and the real world, the physical world, that we do. We've separated it and said that there is nothing other than the material world. They don't have that, and therefore it's much easier for them to have these psychic experiences, to see other worlds. They almost take it for granted. We've got cut off from them. So the irony might be is that it could be that technology helps us get back to that, and it all blends somewhere in the middle, and there'll be good and bad to that. But I definitely think that where we're heading, it's not going to be a wall of, right, well, that's it, everything's now in a computer. I think it will now be an opportunity to see how that can expand what we think life is and what we think the universe is. And you mentioned time earlier on. Every other day you hear quantum physicists saying, well, it's strange, isn't it? Things can coexist, particles seem to go backwards and forwards in time. But when you say, well, how do you know then that isn't happening on a macro level? That's denied. But I don't think you can go on like that forever. Very clearly, time and space is not what we've been told.
No, absolutely not. I think, as I've said many times, time and space are not some kind of fundamental scaffolding upon which reality hangs. I think that they themselves are within consciousness, and they're about perception. That is to say, many people have said it, haven't they? Time is an illusion. without really articulating or thinking about what is meant by that. But and has often been said, it's something that we find necessary to make sense of reality as we apprehend it. So things appear to be a sequence of events, past, present, and then future. So in order for us to, with our, relatively limited intelligence or certainly limited senses, our five senses, to make sense of that, we have this framework that's developed and it's linear time. It doesn't really exist as such, but it allows us to, it's a way of looking at what we're perceiving out there and saying, okay, I can handle this because I spoke to you, for example, a couple of weeks ago, but what does that even mean? But that helps us just to wake up in the morning or go to sleep at night and not go insane.
Yes,
So
quite.
that's all that really is. It's just a, it's a, it's all within consciousness, if you see what I mean.
I do. I mean, I think these are absolutely crucial and fascinating conversations. At the same time, I recognize that in the end, you have to get on with it. Time appears to go in one direction, and even though that might not be the whole story, as it turns out, in the end, you have to literally flow with that. And yet, the various paranormal phenomena that I write about in Strange, it makes clear that sometimes there are anomalies. Sometimes, there's tales in the book of people going backwards in time or having visions through time. I think some ghosts are precisely that, not all. I believe there are spirits too. But yeah, when you just start to acknowledge that time and space is leaky, the universe isn't the straightforward thing that we thought that it was, a lot of the paranormal, as we have called it, in a way suddenly becomes inevitable. It becomes obvious that you're going to get moments like that where it reveals itself for what it is. So, I think that's a very exciting thing. And also, I do believe that, again, coming back to technology, we will learn to explore this more. And I think that there'll be a blending, hopefully not in a bad transhumanist way, but in the end, a blending of the best of human consciousness and the best of AI consciousness to explore the universe in whole new ways.
Well, as far as the flow of time is concerned, my kind of theory is that if we take as a premise for a thought experiment the idea that there is only the present moment, there is no actual past, and there is no future as such, is that the past is accessible, and actually the future is in a way as well, is that it's not that the past has somehow gone. It's almost like it's not on the surface of reality anymore. It's not perceivable directly in the way that if you and I were in the same room now, we'd perceive each other. So it's not that that Hitler or the dinosaurs somehow don't exist. It's they're not on the surface reality anymore. Things bubble to the surface and they're perceived by us with our limited perception, and then they go below the surface again, but it's all still there. And this is how psi power, things like remote viewing and other phenomena that people experience, visions, past, and they foresee the future and stuff. All they're doing is perceiving beyond the surface of reality, and that, precognition, for example. And there's so much interesting data and also documented examples of these sort of psi phenomena that's verifiable in, not all of it, of course, but many, many cases that are, very difficult to refute, documented in this kind of 3D reality, saying, well, this person had a dream about this and it happened exactly like that. Or, this person had memory of a former life and there's no way they could have known this, but these other people went and checked it out and it turned out to be true. And yeah, so there's clearly something going on in terms of perception of past and what we call past and future anyway.
I mean, one of the stories that I relate in the book, and the book is mostly not about me directly, but there are a few tales in it of things that have occurred to me, which show why I take it seriously when other people share these things with me, is not quite premonition, and yet where I experience time in a loop more than once, so two times, and cutting a longer story short, and it's told properly in the book. My grandfather, I was about 12 or 13. This was back in the late 70s. My grandfather was very ill. We knew he was going to die at some point, but we thought he had a few months. And so my family took myself, my two sisters, my mum and dad to a caravan in Wales. and just to get away from it all for a little bit. And that one morning I sat up in the bunk, and just pulled the curtain back and looked out, and I saw coming down the path towards the caravan my mother, looking very upset. She was crying, and I immediately thought, oh no, I know what's happened here. My grandfather's died, and she's just found out. And in those days, pre-mobile phone, she would have had to have gone to like the cottage that rented the caravan to find out. Anyway, she came in, and that was exactly what had happened. And she was, of course, extremely upset. And there was tears, and my sisters and my dad trying to comfort her. And this went on for 3 or 4 minutes. And then I woke up, and I thought, oh, okay, it's a dream. Thank goodness for that. But was it? Because then, and I had a very eerie feeling, I pulled back the curtain exactly as I had in what I thought was a dream. And there indeed was my mother walking down towards the caravan crying. And the next few minutes panned out exactly as I had experienced it. It wasn't like a vague sort of, oh, it's a bit like what I dreamt. It was the same cycle of time going round again. And I actually was aware of it, and I knew exactly who was going to say what side of the room somebody was going to walk to. And I was watching this like almost open mouthed in shock, and I could predict everything that was about to happen, and it did. And this went on again for 3 or 4 minutes. And then when it got to the place where previously I'd woken up, happily I didn't wake up yet again, and time took its normal course. But I have heard other people say to me they've experienced time. It's like it got stuck in a groove and then managed to bounce forward again. And I'm totally open to that because of my own experience. I mean, it was so real. It wasn't like a dream. It was just real, and it happened twice. But what was so fascinating was second time round, I knew that I was in that loop, and I knew what was about to happen. And I didn't appear to act differently myself, but I knew in my head what was going to happen next. So time is very weird, and sometimes you get these glitches, and I believe that I experienced that for myself.
Yeah, as someone speaking personally who's never had any experience of what you could call paranormal or supernatural events, not even lights in the sky, that was, just nothing strange really, to borrow your book title. One thing that I have experienced a few times in my life very powerfully, and it stops you in your tracks, is deja vu. And there's various theories about what that is, but for me personally, I can listen to testimony from yourself, all the people you've spoken with, and all the countless researchers and authors I've read in my lifetime looking into these things, particularly, talking to quote unquote ordinary people and how they've experienced paranormal events, and find it so compelling and resonate strongly with it. But I would just say that my own experiences of deja vu were enough to convince me that something's going on, because it's not just about the mental experience of it, the left brain, the rational experience. It's about the emotion associated with the event and the meaning that you attribute to it. A lot of people, paranormal researchers talk about this, don't they? Particularly in regard to OBEs and NDEs. What meaning does the experiencer get from this event? And that's one of the most important things. It's one of the things, of course, isn't it? You look at the research that Rupert Sheldrake does in these sorts of areas, that a lot of the mainstream, the scientism people, they disregard people's emotional response, whereas quite often that's the crux of the experience.
Definitely. I mean, something I try to bring out in the strange book is how people feel about their paranormal experiences. And I think that is something that is often neglected. It kind of gets boiled down to the facts, and you miss something. And there's one tale in there of a chap called Mike Waller, named, and he wrote me a piece for the book, and somebody I've known for years and trust. And I can't remember whether we spoke about this before, but he was out walking with his dog in Hong Kong. He was stationed out there working there at one point, and came across this sort of strange ghostly figure made out of lots of little spheres of light, that it made up a humanoid figure. And later on, he discovered that there'd been a battle there in the Second World War, and he thought it was related to that. But what really struck him was, and the dog was going mad, but he got this incredible sense of sadness from this creature, and a sense of like longing. It wanted to reach out to him, and he didn't in the moment know how to respond to it. And he, is somebody that has a belief in mysticism and that, but he then realized after this had finished and the apparition vanished that he wished he'd reached out and said a mantra, anything, to try to connect with it, and he didn't. There was a longing there that he felt from it, and then he then felt regret that he hadn't been able to do anything to help it. And there's a few things like that. So, when people see ghosts or have a psychic experience or an out-of-body experience, it's often very related to a state of mind, and people in a difficult state of mind, often that's when they detach from their body. There's a story in the book where a lady who, of course, was elderly when I spoke to her, but when she was a little girl, her father came back from the war after a few years of being away. She didn't know him. She'd been very small when he'd left. And suddenly to her, there was this stranger just living in the house. And her way of dealing with it was that when he tried to talk to her, she would literally exit her body and she'd be up hovering, watching it, safe in that kind of strange bubble. And I know what skeptics would say, oh, well, she just imagined that or blah, blah, blah. But she said, no, this was real. It was an ability that she had. And it was because she couldn't face the fear of trying that she didn't feel that she knew. So, and you often find that, and there's other tales where people have gone through difficult personal times, and again, it's been a time where they escape. And the skeptic would say, well, that's what you did. You kind of had a kind of a hallucination. But I don't agree with that. I think that we do have these abilities, and I think some people find that that's the perfect time to do it, and it's a way of just stepping away from the immediate trauma. So, yeah, there is an emotional level to the paranormal, but I think should be spoken about a lot more.
So you spoke earlier, you mentioned about that sort of shamanic dimension to the human experience, so our interaction with the world around us, and particularly in our past, and how we've got perhaps innate abilities, psychic abilities, telekinesis, extrasensory perception of all types, who knows what, again, that we have lost touch with. And this got me thinking about one of the things I'm particularly interested in shamanic culture is that of megalithic culture. Now, there's megaliths all over the world, but I'm particularly interested in that of Western Europe and, Britain in particular. The stuff that's closest to us physically and maybe depending on our heritage, closest to us, spiritually in some way, if I can put it that way. And I'm thinking about earth energies and the idea itself that, in some of all this, you begin to say, well, if these paranormal and supernatural experiences are being had and these phenomena are manifesting, what does that say about the nature of the Earth and the solar system and the cosmos? And for me, it's like, again, it's Rupert Sheldrake's idea of the sun being conscious, and that consciousness is in everything because everything is within fundamental consciousness. So the Earth itself is alive. I don't necessarily mean in the simple Gaia idea. Based in environmentalism, but partly that. And I remember being very inspired by the work of Paul Devereux and the late great John Michel, and talking about this, the network of power places around the earth and how all that comes together. And I'm mentioning this in this context because I know you've written about these things in the past. And in fact, the first time I encountered you as as a writer and researcher was in your work in crop circles, and all of these things being, as I referred to in our last talk, as messages to us as beings who have lost touch with our deeper connection with the cosmos, being messages saying, five senses and three dimensions is not all there is. And so maybe thinking about the AI future, that this is something that, yes, as you hinted at, that something can reconnect us here. And the AI, in fact, isn't just a dispassionate, inhuman technological endeavor, but maybe, as you might even have seen, as some people hinted at CERN, and with regard to how some of the researchers there think and feel about what they're doing, here we go again, feel, is that maybe in future with AI research and overlapping and interconnection with these fields, the cutting edge and the distant past, that maybe the more things change, the more they stay the same, if you see what I mean. And that a lot of the things that our ancient ancestors experienced and engaged in, we're just doing our version of it now. So maybe the technology, if there's a, a spiritual or a mystical dimension to it, dare I go so far. We already see ceremonial, even ritual kind of aspects to what's happening with this technology that maybe that's this will probably alarm some hardcore materialists, but maybe there is that kind of dimension to some of the technological developments coming down the line. And yeah, it may be more than just a series of useful tools for number crunching and making life easier for the human populace, by taking yet more jobs away, and as you said it last time, putting us all on a universal basic income.
I mean, if you look at what technology is really capable of, and then you just project that a little bit further forward, and quantum computing is a bit clunky at the moment, but nonetheless, what it's capable of is incredible. It's making astonishing calculations that we would have taken decades to do in minutes, and they think it's only going to get faster and faster. In the end, it'll be a bit like Douglas Adams. You're going to get a computer that is going to work out what life, the universe, and everything actually is, and hopefully we'll get more than the number 42. But I think once it peels away the layers of how this all ticks, yeah, I think science is going to have to accept that the mystics probably had it right all along. Indeed, I think that's one of the fears of many scientists, is that they almost don't want to shout too loudly about what they are discovering, because it does basically back up mysticism. And of course, they've hated that for so long. And yet, it's like a horseshoe, it's classic. You've got mysticism and science gradually coming around to meet each other in the same place. And I think once it does, and I think it will, and I think again, if it's AI and not somebody with a boundary skeptic sort of mindset, it's just going to look dispassionately at what's there and go, well, of course, this is how it works. Right, let's actually now explore that. That's when everything will change. I mean, if it worked out how psychic forces worked, for instance, you might well wind up with a psychic computer at some point. Now, I know there are people that fight that and say, no, that is something only organic life will be able to do. Well, I mean, let's see. I guess we're going to find out. But this notion of everything in some way holding consciousness, I mean, that's, a very old belief that, we call animism, and the belief that, everything in some way has its own identity that you can relate to. Another aspect that I think comes into that, which I discuss in the book, is when you psychically imprint. We all do this all the time, I think. And, people can actually do it. Kind of with dowsers, can create an energy point and then invite other people into the room, and other people can find the energy point. So, in other words, one person has imprinted their consciousness on that spot, and others can then detect it. And we're doing that all the time. Everything we think and we feel is, in some way, albeit generally subtly, imprinting on the universe around us, and it leaves marks. And I mean, I think that's why psychometry works, for instance, where you can hold an object if you're very psychically adept. And you can tell a lot of things about the person that once held or owned that object, because it has in some way been imprinted. So to me, that's how a lot of this works. And I think that's why some ghosts, for instance, come back, if not always to the same place, but they can come back to objects even when they've been placed in new houses. They get drawn back to them because they have an imprint. And sometimes they can get drawn to people. You can have a ghost that haunts one person. That person can then move somewhere else, and the ghost is still with them. So there's a link there. It's not necessarily with the house where they were. So, yeah, I think consciousness gets transferred from us to objects, but also the objects may well hold some basic level of consciousness, albeit very low level in the first place. But that combination, as Sheldrake, has tried to explore, I think is a very powerful and not really yet understood aspect to the whole of reality. And I think when that does get revealed, it will be impossible to go back to, the world that we're in now, where it's just material reality and a few mad psychics. It's not going to be like that, and it will blend, and we will understand how it all dovetails. And I think we will have a much greater understanding of the universe, which will take us to some really amazing places, perhaps in more ways than one.
That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
Legalizefreedom.com.